Hello and welcome to Food Stuff. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about ramen.
Yes, ramen noodles. And they're way more than those 49-cent dry noodle packs or cup of soup things that you can get at grocery stores. And a lot of us, me included, used to survive college.
And my post-college era, certainly.
Yeah. Ramen of the non-dried and packaged variety is currently kind of a food trend in the U.S. and in other places around the globe. And it's becoming more and more commonplace. And it's also food you probably associate with Japan.
Probably, for good reason. Yeah. But buckle up, friends. This is another one of those episodes in which we talk about really depressing stuff in the middle of something that you love. So,
yeah.
Yay.
It's going to be okay. We're going to get through this together.
It will be. Let's begin.
Yes. So first, big shout out to George Soltz, The Untold History of Ramen, as an excellent book and source for this episode. Very helpful.
Also, basically all of it is available for free to read on Google Books. So check that out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are so many takes on ramen. Almost every city in Japan has their own insert city name style. And then all the versions outside of Japan, it's just a lot. So keep that in mind as we talk about ramen. Japan's Ramen Museum, and yes, that exists, and yes, we will be talking about it further, recognizes officially 19 regional varieties.
Huh. Okay. But at its most basic, what is it?
It's noodles, stock, tare, which is the sauce that is used for flavor.
Tare.
Tare. Well, there's no accent over that, and that is my bad.
it's okay.
And the toppings, if any.
Ramen noodles are a specific type of noodle that's generally been alkalized. Changing the pH levels in a wheat flour dough affect its properties, including the texture and color, because it affects some of the dough's chemical compounds and gluten interactions.
And the noodles are made with a combination of flour, salt, and water that has often been infused with kansui.
Kansui.
See, I even write out the pronunciations, and it's like my brain goes, no, it's this way.
I'm not a total expert. I took a little bit of Japanese linguistics in college, but so I might be screwing it up too. There's also regional accents.
Cool. Well, feel free to correct me at any time, Lauren.
Okay. No, you're trying. I usually just toss French words to you, so this is totally fair.
Absolutely.
Okay. Kansui, anyway, is an alkaline mineral water. It's a solution with potassium carbonate and sodium carbonate or bicarbonate. It's a brownish liquid that's hard to find outside of Asia sometimes, but can be substituted for with regular old sodium bicarbonate, aka baking soda.
That alkalinity gives the noodles the hint of yellow and their slipperiness and chewiness. And as you go further south or west in Japan, the less kansui is used in ramen, which impacts the color. In the north, where the baking soda makes up about 30 to 40% of the water, the ramen will have more color to it than the south.
The alkalinity also affects the rate of broth absorption of the noodles. And other noodles that may be served at ramen shops can include udon, which are a thicker, softer white wheat noodles, and soba, which are usually thinner, kind of nutty buckwheat noodles. Sometimes ramen noodles are served without broth also. But if you are going to broth.
If you're going to broth. Chefs, simmer seafood, primarily clams or dried fish, meat, usually chicken or pork, or vegetables, typically garlic, onions, scallions, or ginger, or a combination of those things for quite a long time, quite a long time. All kinds of stuff I didn't mention can be used in the broth, though, like apples or potatoes.
And the broth can be a clear consomme-style thing or a, like, cloudy, gelatin-rich stock that you get from cooking down bones.
Mm-hmm. And the seasoning sauce, our tare, is most often a choice of soy sauce, shoyu, fermented soybean paste, miso, or salt, shio. But that also can vary, and a small amount of ramens don't use any tare. Are you seeing a pattern here? Very customizable.
Yeah.
As far as toppings go, you're most likely to run across Chinese-style roasted pork called chashu. And sliced green onions. But you can find just about anything on there if you peruse enough menus.
Yeah. Other most common items include mushrooms, soft-boiled egg, slices of spongy fish cake, seaweed slices, butter, bonito flakes, which are fish flakes, garlic chips, and corn.
And you can find ramen in over 80,000 restaurants, and 35,000 of those are ramen specialty shops
in
Japan.
Just in Japan?
Yes, in Japan. 80% of these are small businesses. In a similar way to Vegemite, ramen is sort of tied to Japan and Japanese culture and sometimes described as a symbol of Japanese soft power.
In a survey of 2,000 Tokyo area residents, the Fuji Research Institute found that the Japanese consider instant noodles to be Japan's greatest invention of the 20th century.
Wow. Oh, and that instant stuff. 87.5 billion packets a year sold in 2005, about $3 billion.
By 2012, that was over 100 billion servings per year, enough for 14 packets for every single person on the face of this planet.
That is a lot of instant ramen.
Oh, it is. But how did we get here? How did we create this ramen craze? I mean, not us personally.
No.
Like humanity in general.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. We're going to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
But first, we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes.
So there are three competing stories about the origin of ramen, but one thing they all have in common, ramen is from China, not Japan.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so Japan has borrowed lots of culture from China over the centuries. Their system of writing, calendar, and Buddhist practices, for example, all originated in China. And those other two types of noodles frequently found in Japanese cuisine, soba and udon, also came from China. But those things all date back at least a millennium or so. Ramen is more recent, though. And speaking of language, you can tell partially based on the way that the word is written in Japanese. The modern Japanese language has two alphabets, one for native words called hiragana and one for foreign words called katakana. Hiragana provides the phonetic spellings for kanji, which are those conceptual characters. But yeah, okay, so ramen is still not written with native hiragana or kanji, but in that foreign loanword alphabet. So it hasn't been kicking around all that long.
One story claims that scholar Xu Shunsui fled Manchu rule in China, bringing with him the recipe for Chinese style noodle soup sometime in the 1600s-ish. A companion to the feudal lord Tokugawa Mitsukuni, Xu supposedly gave out lots of useful advice, including how to improve the local udon noodle soup and dashi broth with stuff like garlic, green onions, and ginger. Some food historians credit this as the beginning of ramen in Japan. But there's not a lot of written evidence of this.
Yeah, well, and it didn't really develop further from there. It kind of, like, stopped.
Yeah, that was sort of it.
Yeah.
The second tale of ramen's arrival to Japan involves the country becoming more open to foreigners in the 19th century.
This was due to Japan's kind of Western-driven imperial restoration in the mid-1800s. They'd been basically closed to Eastern immigrants and certainly to Western immigrants and even merchants for about 250 years. And at first, Chinese people migrated to Japan looking for work opportunities, especially in helping the Japanese interact with the new influx of Westerners.
And the Chinese coming to Japan brought with them a chicken broth and handmade noodle combo called la mien. The Japanese referred to this noodle soup as Nankin Soba, Nanjing noodles, named for China's capital. Interestingly, Nankin Soba wasn't viewed as a whole meal, but rather a closing act you had after your main meal was consumed. An ad for Nankin Soba appeared in a print ad in 1884.
And it was more simple than what ramen would become. It didn't contain the toppings or the sauces. To get those, we have to turn to
the third and most likely series of events that brought ramen to Japan, which is a bit more specific take on the second version we just talked about. In the 1880s, Chinese migrants started settling in Yokohama and opening restaurants with dishes from home, including noodle soup dishes targeted primarily to foreigners. Yokohama is a port city. A couple of decades passed, bringing us to 1910, when Tokyo's first Japanese-owned and run Chinese restaurant, Ryraken, whipped up a dish of noodles submerged in a soy sauce seasoned broth that they called shinasoba.
The restaurant employed Chinese chefs and was popular for putting Japanese twists on Chinese staples.
Mm-hmm. And shina was the then imperialist Japanese phonetic word for China, and soba, of course, refers to noodles. However, the noodles being used in shina soba were made with wheat flour, not buckwheat. So basically the translation is Chinese noodles. Over the next couple of years, this early precursor to ramen spread and became localized, at first mostly available at food carts and, strangely, Western-style restaurants.
Hmm.
It was a popular item for blue-collar workers who didn't have much in the way of extra time or cash. Urbanization and industrialization meant more people were working in cities, which only helped with ramen's popularity, and even by the 1910s, a mechanical noodle-making device existed.
At the time, Japan was in its aggressive colonialism stage of its imperial renewal. It was waging war with its neighbors, eventually taking over Korea, Taiwan, and parts of the South Pacific and China. This added financial strain to the urbanization that was already going on, and thus a need for inexpensive and filling food.
Mm-hmm. And plus, there was a sense of power that came with enjoying this foreign dish. In her book, Modern Japanese Cuisine, Food Power and National Identity, Katsurina Joanna Schwertke, sorry if I butchered your name, wrote, "By physically interacting with China through the ingestion of Chinese food and drink, the Japanese masses were brought closer to the idea of empire."
Whew.
Yeah.
Imperialism and cannibalism a little bit in there.
A little bit. Yay. Yeah.
The wars also drove rice shortages, and thus wheat-based products like ramen became more popular.
And as it did with so much, World War II, and specifically Japan's defeat in that war, changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, during the war, rationing meant that not too many people were making or eating shinan noodles. After the war's end, the Chinese government and press protested the use of the word shina due to its imperialist connotation. And since it was tied up with the Japanese aggression and the atrocities that resulted in the deaths of 20 million Chinese, it was viewed as racist and the use of it was mostly discontinued. Chuka soba became the new name for Chinese noodles. Food shortages and widespread hunger plagued Japan, the worst of it from 1944 to 1947. Restaurants and food carts weren't permitted to earn a profit until 1949, and during the U.S. occupation of Japan from 1945 to 1952, Japan relied heavily on U.S. imports for food, the primary of those being lard and wheat.
This was kind of on purpose by the U.S. government.
Yeah. A little bit more on that in a second.
Yeah.
Consequently, stuff made with wheat as an ingredient grew in popularity, including chuka soba slash ramen, aka ramen. And this, in turn, really shaped the Japanese diet. Lard and wheat became building blocks in a lot of things we associate with Japanese cuisine, like okonomiyaki and gyoza, that were labeled stanima food. Stamina food, she says. Stamina food.
I didn't even notice. I was like, yeah, no, that's the word. That's absolutely.
That's correct.
Sure.
Yes.
Sounds good.
Food this meant food that was filling and kept the hunger away for longer. And that term is still in use today. And we should mention.
Oh, yeah. Back to the extra depressing note. Yeah.
Yeah. That during this time, the U.S. kept food rationing and a ban on outside food vendors in place, which meant that much of this shuka soba was made with black market wheat. I forgot about this fact. And at black market food stands. Translation, it was illegal. People went to jail for it.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. And another thing we should mention is that the U.S. was kind of sort of using the import of wheat and other foods to contain communism.
Yep.
Uh-huh, yep. The U.S. hoped to prevent any uprisings from breaking out in response to frustrations about the city's poor management when it came to the distribution of food. In this way, the U.S. would be viewed as a charitable force at a time of need and the Japanese government as functioning when the Communist Party was claiming very loudly that it wasn't. Yeah. And depending on which side of the generation gap you fell on, ramen was either viewed as a food for poor people to be embarrassed by, you didn't want to eat it in public, or a food that served as a savior during a time of starvation. That was mostly felt by people who came into adulthood after the war.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Once the U.S. occupation came to an end and Japan's economy started turning around, we come to a huge milestone in the history of ramen in 1958. What was it, you ask?
What? What could it possibly be?
I don't know. You probably know. But humor me. It was packaged instant ramen brought to you by the founder of Nissin Foods Corporation, Ando Momofuku. As it was chicken flavored, it was called chicken ramen. Ramen from the Chinese word la, meaning pull, and mian, meaning noodle. When it first debuted, it was marketed as something for women and children in the middle class as nourishing and healthy food for nuclear families. easily acquired at the grocery store.
Although it was a little expensive at first, certainly pricier than going to a ramen shop. The convenience of being able to make ramen at home, though, made it gain popularity quickly. And Ando's story is just about as heartwarming as corporate stories really get. He was born in Japanese-occupied Taiwan and studied in Japan, later becoming a citizen. He worked as the chairman of a credit association after World War II, but they went bankrupt in 1957. Looking for a new life purpose and kind of wanting to apologize for this failure of this credit union, he remembered a moment from the day that Japan surrendered, where he saw people lining up at this makeshift ramen restaurant among the wreckage of Osaka and decided that what people needed was a food that was tasty, non-perishable, inexpensive, safe, filling, and could be ready in less than 3 minutes. And he reportedly believed that peace will come to the world when all its people have enough to eat. And he wanted to help achieve that peace.
That's lovely. Mm-hmm. We used to do a show called Step of Genius, and almost everybody here kind of had a hand in it at one point.
Yeah.
It's like an animated video series, and I believe we did one.
Yeah?
Yeah, on ramen. It was about inventors and like how they invented their products. And I'm sure you can still find it if you're interested.
Yeah, it's on that internet thing.
That thing, yeah. So anyway, ramen, once again, gained popularity among workers in cities like Tokyo and Osaka in the 60s. And as Japan's economy improved and more standalone restaurants were built, more and more restaurants, as opposed to food carts that were previously making and selling ramen, started to sell ramen. More restaurants did. It was becoming less of a food associated with the poor, in other words. Simultaneously, as European and American foods poured into Japan, Japanese people clung to ramen as a Japanese food that was now perceived with some nostalgia as a national dish.
Huh.
Yeah. And in many ways, it's fitting that we did rice before this, as wheat became a rice substitute when rice was scarce, and also because of this interesting claim making the rounds at the time.
Whew.
Yeah.
This one.
Yep. The Ministry of Health and Welfare actively promoted Western food as the healthier food, a proposition backed by some nutritionist and pointed to as the reason for Western superiority.
Ooh.
Yeah. The character for rice was described as suggesting that people eat because they exist, and that these people were thus resigned and passive. And the character for wheat suggested that people exist because they eat, and thus they are progressive and active. So according to this, people who ate rice lost the will to be active, and people who ate wheat had initiative and were motivated because you wanted to improve the wheat by combining it with other things. So the logic went.
Huh.
Yeah. Worse. Here's an actual quote from a nutritionist. Parents who feed their children solely white rice are dooming them to a life of idiocy. When one eats rice, one's brain gets worse. When one compares Japanese to Westerners, one finds that the former has an approximately 20% weaker mind than the latter. This is evident from the fact that few Japanese have received the Nobel Prize. Japan ought to completely abolish its rice paddies and aim for a full bread diet. What?
That is just
terrible.
The most racist thing that I've actually heard in a minute. And
I mean, that's really bad. I can't believe. And it's like the complete opposite of what we think now in a less racist way, but just that the Western diet is so unhealthy.
Yeah.
The title of the pamphlet this came from, by the way, was called Eating Rice Makes You Stupid. Yeah, it's awful. Moving on from that racist nonsense.
Yeah. Ando developed cup ramen, packaged in a styrofoam cup that serves as a bowl, in the late 1960s, supposedly when he saw American supermarket executives using a styrofoam coffee cup as a like makeshift ramen bowl during product demonstrations.
Oh. In 1971, cup ramen became commercially available, and it got lots of free publicity thanks to the 1972 Osamu Sanzo incident, when the wife of an innkeeper in Nagano was taken hostage by members of the United Red Army. A Japanese tactical assault team responded, and during the resulting televised 10-day siege, all parties involved lived off of cup ramen.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. cup o' noodles arrived in the U.S. in 1973. I just did like a weird gesture when I said that. I feel like you have to kind of do this arm thing.
Cup noodles.
Yeah. Like it's...
Cup noodles.
Anyway, no one can see it. But yeah. Lauren appreciated it when I brought it to her attention. Otherwise, she wouldn't have noticed. Also during this decade, we see some of the first seeds for Kraft Ramen with, quote, salarymen, are men who successfully escaped their jobs to become self-employed, maybe making ramen. And then comes the fabulous 80s, and they were indeed fabulous for ramen. It was trending. It was fashionable. It was all over Japan. The number of specialty ramen shops increased drastically. As the price point rose, blue-collar ramen customers were replaced with younger city folk who were dubbed the new breed.
Yeah.
Yeah. In 1982, the small city of Kitakata started doing ramen tours. People waited in line for hours to get a taste of a special local ramen, and this practice was well known enough to have a name for the people that engaged in it. Ramen Gyoretsu?
Yeah.
Yay! Awesome. Ramen's popularity explosion only continued into the 90s, with ramen chefs becoming celebrities, ramen video games, and a ramen museum, which is really more of a food court, opened in 1994. Later, an instant ramen museum opened, too.
In 2004, Chef David Chang opened Momofuku Noodle Bar in New York City, which became so trendy that it would cement ramen as a destination-worthy food in the minds of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2005, ramen went to space.
Space?
Ando developed it for the Japanese astronaut Soichi Noguchi's space shuttle trip. It came, of course, in a vacuum-sealed bag, and the noodles were skinnier so that they could be cooked in hot, not boiling water, and the broth was more like a sauce, kind of, so it would stick to the noodles.
Uh-huh.
When Ando would pass away in 2007, Noguchi eulogized him to a full stadium of mourners.
Wow.
Ando. In 2015, a 9-seat ramen-ya, a ramen restaurant in Tokyo called Tsuta, became the first ramen joint to earn a Michelin star.
And that brings us to today, when ramen has become this fashionable, hip food that we see as a representation of Japan. And you can find it in cities around the world.
New York Times food critic Pete Wells once wrote that ramen's popularity represents a kind of greater shift in what's trendy in restaurants today. You know, it's got these bold and heady flavors, and it can be fancy, but it's not fussy. It's a very homey and comforting kind of dish.
Man, and I really want some ramen now.
I buckled and bought some from downstairs yesterday.
I might, too.
It's like $15, but it's really good.
Mm-hmm. That was one of my favorite things I had in Japan was a bowl of ramen. It was so good. All right. So that's the history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's talk about some of this nitty-gritty stuff.
Yeah, but first, let's take another quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. So, traditionally speaking,
yes,
ramen noodle making has been a labor-intensive process because, all right, you've got to knead your water, flour, salt, and nkansui together to hydrate the flour, to give the gluten molecules in it access to each other. In the videos that I've seen, this is accomplished by rolling out the dough with this huge, wide shaft of bamboo. Then you have to rest the dough to let the gluten all link up, and then either hand pull the dough into noodles or, more often, tediously, like, stretch and roll the dough out super thin and flat. Then you roll it up like a tube of tinfoil. Uh-huh. You roll the dough along a bar, and then remove the bar and slice the dough into noodles, which, if you want curlier noodles, you can kind of hand scrunch. Gluten science, by the way, is a topic for a whole other episode, y'all.
Absolutely.
That was the super short version of how gluten works in a noodle. I got tired. I had to go research lembas. Okay.
It was very important.
It was. Okay. These days, some chefs do still prepare noodles by hand, but it is more common for a ramen restaurant to order fresh or even dried ramen noodles from a manufacturer. These producers use electric machines to knead, roll out, slice, and scrunch the dough. Although, for the best of both worlds, there are a few ramen joints in China and Japan that employ, scare quotes employ, robots to make their noodles.
Robots.
And this isn't quite like if you're picturing like Rosie from the Jetsons.
I was.
Doing that kind of thing. It's not quite Rosie. They're just these robotic arms that do this repetitive work of noodle making. Sort of the same way that we're used to seeing like robotic arms do the work of like car making.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Simply. That's just that work.
Yeah.
It's easy. I could
oh, sure.
Create a robot that does that.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm lying.
Yeah.
Technological innovation is really incredible. Anyway, but so that's traditional ramen. If we're going to talk about instant ramen, let's talk about the cooking times of all of these products for a second.
Let's do that.
Annie seems dubious. I promise you this is going places. Okay, so fresh noodles are delicious,
yes.
And they cook super fast, which is an important factor for busy folks who just want to be able to order food at a ramen-ya and like start eating within like 3 to 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The downside is that fresh noodles only last a couple days, and that's only if you keep them like cool and dry. The big draw of dry packaged noodles is that they're shelf stable for a couple years, because just about all the moisture that would let microorganisms grow has been removed. But dry noodles take a bunch longer to cook. So, how do dry instant ramen noodles cook so dang fast?
I have no idea.
The key to this is also the reason why instant ramen has traditionally been so disproportionately fatty for something that's just effing noodles and salt.
Yeah.
They're flash fried during manufacturing.
Oh.
The process goes like this. First, you create your dough, make it into noodles, cook the noodles, then air dry them just a little bit so that they're not like soggy. You then take these noodles and deep fry them at above the boiling point of water, like 160 degrees Celsius, aka like 320 Fahrenheit. And the remaining molecules of water inside these noodles evaporate so quickly in the heat that they leave tiny pockets of air behind in the finished noodles. This both gets rid of that germ-friendly water content for shelf stability and also leaves you with a craggy noodle microstructure that vastly increases each noodle's surface area. So when you drop your Blocko instant noodles into hot water, the water gets just all up into those tiny air pockets and cooks the noodles way faster than regular dried noodles can cook.
That's so cool.
I know, right?
I never even thought about it.
I kind of
so
freaked
cool.
out. I love it. These crags are also why uncooked ramen noodles have a sort of like cracker-like texture, whereas uncooked dry spaghetti certainly does not. I don't know if anyone else has eaten both of those things, but
I have. Yeah. I actually have a really embarrassing story about it, but we will move on.
Maybe I can get you to talk about that in your favorite bowl of ramen after.
Yes.
After the rest of this. Okay. All right. Thanks to technology, some instant ramen noodles are made by non-frying methods. These generally fall into the category of like baking and or air drying. And the idea here is that you, again, take cooked noodles, then you coat them in just a very thin layer of oil and expose them to hot, fast-moving air. The heat is at least 145 degrees Celsius, aka 300 Fahrenheit. The heat and airflow are enough to create the crags that you want in the noodles with much, much, much less cooking fat.
Hmm.
This is how those home air fryers basically work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And all of this brings us to nutrition.
Oh, boy. I'm sure it's very healthy and I should be eating it every day.
Every day. Yay. No, that's nutrition segment over.
Oh, okay. Great.
No. Okay. So the nutrition of fresh cooked ramen, of course, depends heavily on the recipe.
Yeah.
And as we spent this entire episode talking about, there are infinite recipes for ramen. generally, I would say that if you're going to add any of the extras that many ramen-ya offer, go for the extra meat or extra veg, not extra noodles. Mm-hmm. That'll help you keep feeling more sated more longer.
Yeah.
Which was the best.
It was the best phrasing.
Phrasing I've ever used. I do not need to tell you that instant ramen into and of itself is not a health food. It's mostly carbohydrates and salt and contains almost twice as much fat as protein. And the fat is typically palm oil, which is a bad fat. Instant ramen also has a smattering of vitamins and minerals other than salt, but its proteins are of the types that you really need to complement with stuff from other foods in order to give your body all the stuff it needs to just get work done. So overall, instant ramen will make you feel full for a little while, but it won't really keep you going strong, you know?
Yeah. When I was in college, I didn't use the flavor packet.
Yeah?
And I would add hot sauce
Oh.
And soy sauce and mushrooms and spinach. That was my... So I, like, kind of improved it.
Yeah. I mean, the oil is really all in the noodles, not in the seasoning packet. So if you were looking for
salt.
A low-fat food, but the fat will keep you... The fat is part of what makes it filling, so...
Okay.
Yeah. But you missed out on some of the salt.
Yes, some of it.
And strangely enough, mushrooms and corn, which are two classic ramen toppings, are basically the two vegetables that'll help your body make the best use of that protein in those ramen noodles.
Hmm.
So you were doing 50% of it in college without even knowing.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to eat it, and look, y'all, like to this day, I love imported instant ramens. They're so good.
True story, you guys.
And like it's quick and it's easy and it's relatively inexpensive to just add some frozen veg to the pot.
Mm-hmm.
I like spinach as well. You can also stir in a whole egg after you turn the heat off at the end of the cooking process. So the residual heat will kind of cook the white for an egg drop soup type effect, and the yolk will sort of thicken the broth.
Mm.
So it's tasty.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, all this being said, like we never want to slam a food that's inexpensive and tasty and can be prepared easily, especially like so easily that in emergency situations, it's a pretty common thing to ship out to people.
Mm-hmm.
Anthropologists who have studied ramen's worldwide use say that overall, ramen does more good than harm nutrition-wise, especially in cities with food deserts where the urban poor really don't have access to anything more nutritious than instant ramen.
Yeah. Good for you, instant ramen.
Yeah. But back to Annie's earlier point about the salt. What about MSG?
What about it?
Okay. So monosodium glutamate is a flavoring that helps add like savory, salty tastes to foods. And it got a lot of undeserved bad press starting in 1968 when a doctor got a letter published in the New England Journal of Medicine pondering why he often felt ill after eating at American Chinese restaurants. His concepts that he threw out in this letter were maybe it's the soy sauce, maybe it's the cooking wine, and or maybe it's MSG. And for some reason, the press and the public just kind of went wild with the MSG thing. They were calling it Chinese restaurant syndrome. Research published in 2006 that reviewed almost 40 years of research studies found no serious side effects or sensitivities in humans to the amount of MSG that you would consume through food.
Really?
Maybe like headache or dry mouth if you're eating on an empty stomach and you're not properly hydrated.
Mm-hmm.
But that's it. The really bad effects that researchers found only happened when they injected MSG under the skin of baby mice.
Oof.
So don't inject MSG under your skin and you'll be fine.
Yeah, just don't do that.
Yeah. Also, side note, referring to a problem with a widely used chemical compound is specifically Chinese-related is pretty racist. So don't do that either.
Well, it's news to me that it was just one dude like, hey.
Like, I wonder.
And then the media's like, ah. Okay.
Yeah.
That's certainly something we'll have to look into.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the whole story of how it was derived by some Japanese scientists. It's super fascinating. So
cool. Well, here is our random portion. Random. I just wanted to mention ramen burgers. Just in case you didn't know they were a thing.
I actually, what on earth is a ramen burger?
Oh, it's a burger with two like instant packages of like the blocks.
The cakes?
Yeah.
Instead of buns?
Yeah. And they're kind of cooked and you eat it. I mean, yeah, that's how I've had it. But I think you can get like a burger with buns and the two blocks of ramen noodles.
My face is going through this number of confused contortions.
I
have
twitching.
Nothing to say about that. because restaurateurs will put gold leaf on anything to make a headline, you could at one point buy a $180 bowl of ramen from Manhattan restaurant Koa. It also came with like wagyu beef and shaved truffle. And now your face is doing the same thing that my face was just doing.
It is. I better be really full for a long time after that. I get hungry in an hour. I'm going to be so mad. Like I'm going to eat this. But hypothetically.
Also, the restaurant closed. So.
Oh, well, okay.
But if you are eating ramen out at a ramen shop, cultural notes on doing that. It is, in fact, okay, even preferred, to kind of angle your head over the bowl and slurp your noodles, like make a slurpy sound.
Mm-hmm.
The heat of the broth will start overcooking the noodles within just 8 minutes. So you have to do it fast. And the slurping will help cool and aerate the broth, bringing the scent to your nose. And the sound is actually considered a compliment to the chef. Also, when and if you put your chopsticks down, do not stick them upright in the bowl. That's reminiscent of a Japanese funerary practice. So don't stick chopsticks into bowls. Lay them across the top.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
When I was having my delicious bowl of ramen in Japan, everywhere was the sound of slurping. It was like, for when I first walked in, I didn't know what was going on.
What is this? What is this?
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful, though.
It was. And it was delicious.
If you want to make ramen at home, but A, don't want to use instant noodles, and B, can't find regular ramen noodles, can you make your own chewy, perfect noodles out of regular, non-alkalized pasta?
I don't know.
Well, you can't really. But if you add 2 or 3 teaspoons of baking soda per quart of water that you boil your pasta in, they'll come out yellower and springier.
Okay. So, a little.
A little. Close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Kind of, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, tell us about your bowl of ramen. What was it? I need to hear.
It's actually funny because in Japan, a lot of the ramen restaurants, actually, I went to 2 and both of them were this way. It's like a vending machine. I thought you were going to get ramen out of a vending machine.
Oh.
But it's like just how you order.
Yeah, it's how you order. Yeah, there's a machine with like pictures.
Yeah, so I'm like this bumbling tourist trying to figure it out. And I accidentally went to apparently a really famous place. It's, I think you guys probably heard of it, but you go in and you're like in a booth.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like a little, there's like little partitions, like in a voting booth or like a phone booth.
Yeah. And then there's like a little window and there's a kind of a bamboo thing hanging in front of you and they'll roll it up and the food slides out.
You like never interact with a human while you're there.
Mm-mm. But my favorite was I was in Kyoto Station. I was in a train station, and there's a whole floor dedicated to ramen. It's every restaurant on the, I think, 11th floor, 10th or 11th
what?
Is ramen. Yeah. And so I just went into one, and I got one with chicken, like a chicken base.
Uh-huh.
And it was just like the most wonderful and comforting chicken soup ramen mixture I've ever had. It was so good.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
that's wonderful.
It was.
Thank
and
you.
It was huge.
Oh, I know.
It was so big.
I
ate all of it.
Yeah, you did.
No way was I leaving any of that behind.
Thank you for sharing your ramen story.
Oh, yes. Thank you for asking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anytime. Speaking of stories, this brings us to our listener mail.
Listener mail, yes. Sandra wrote in response to our pumpkin episode, I live in Nova Scotia, Canada, and a town here called Windsor hosts an annual pumpkin regatta. What this means is they find, grow massive pumpkins, haul them out, and use them as boats. I kid you not, boats. I'm including the link with some pictures for you as it's an amazingly quirky event, and you all needed to know that pumpkins are not only amazing to eat, but you can also use them as modes of transportation. And the link was amazing. The pictures were amazing. A lot of people wrote us about this, and I want to see it.
In person so much. Yeah, the people like dress up like in costumes for this pumpkin boat race. It's...
I mean, pumpkin boat race.
Pumpkin
the
boat race.
Phrase alone, I just... brings a smile to my face. I want to see it so badly.
Field trip list.
Mm-hmm.
About cinnamon, Angela wrote, a while back, I had also learned that cinnamon was a natural deterrent to ants. The reason I needed to know this is because our cat is a messy eater and leaves crumbles of kibbles on the floor near her food bowl. I feel you there. In summer, we would find little black ants coming in and trying to make off with the kibble crumbs. I had previously tried sprinkling cinnamon in the areas I suspected they entered the house, but they kept thwarting me. This year, when they returned, I decided to show them I was serious and used cinnamon leaf oil. I added some drops of the oil to a cotton ball and swiped it along the baseboards, the likely entrance areas, and could watch them turn tail and run. I had to reapply the oil about twice a week for a few weeks, but so far they seem to have gotten the picture. It's amazing how quickly our kitchen smelled like the holidays. Another fun side story is that when I worked in a production bakery, we would order 10 to 15 pound boxes of cinnamon at a time. We'd fill smaller containers with cinnamon and have to scoop it from the larger box. When the cinnamon would shift in the box, it had a fluidity to it that was mesmerizing. It looked like sloshing water. Pretty cool.
I agree.
That is pretty cool.
I know.
Oh, the fluid dynamics of substances like cinnamon and actually ants are super fascinating. Ants move like fluid. It's so cool.
That is cool. A lot of many people wrote us that the cinnamon thing worked for them in getting rid of ants. So if you've got an ant problem, maybe give it a try.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm gonna.
You got the cat with the kibbles and ants thing going on as well.
I've got some fire ants that just are camping. They're like staking out my house.
Oh no!
And I'm getting like having increasing allergic reactions to them. So
it's time for cinnamon.
It's apparently time for cinnamon.
Yes,
get serious.
Well, if you have any other tips similar to that or any other food or drink-related thing you'd like to write us about, you can do so. Our email is foodstuff@howstuffworks.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at FoodstuffHSW. We're on Instagram at Foodstuff. Thanks so much to our producer, Dylan Fagan, for doing everything that he does. We hope that we'll hear from you, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.